Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, how many times have you watched the new Hard Knocks season with the Jets? It's making me like Aaron Rodgers, and I don't like that feeling.
It's been kind of strange, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because I'd written the guy off as a kind of red-pilled Joe Rogan.
Kind of a dickhead.
You know, yeah, but you know, he's kind of likable, and he can still throw the ball. We'll see if I still like him, you know, week 3 of the season.
Week 8.
Yeah.
Also, Sauce Gardner. It's just your cornerback, all pro.
Now, the problem is we've had previous seasons where the Jets looked really good coming out of Hard
Knocks.
And then let's just say the momentum kind of dissipated around week three.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, we'll try not to butt fumble on the show today.
I think that was a Hard Knocks season, actually. That was a Hard Knocks season.
We're going to talk about fears that Ukraine's counteroffensive has stalled amidst a new funding request to Congress from the Biden administration. This horrifying report by Human Rights Watch about Saudi Arabia's treatment of Ethiopian migrants. Some bad news for Trump in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. Good news about climate change, and then some scary climate change news out of Canada, where they're dealing with these horrific, massive wildfires. Get an election in Ecuador, the far right in Germany, and then a little more flavor from our friend Vivek Ramaswamy, the Republican candidate for president, who's saying, you know, look, to his credit, he's saying different and interesting things about foreign policy.
Great for a weekly segment.
It's great for content. We'll start
Vivek's takes.
Vivek's takes?
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Space, dining and dashing, and more. And then I just spoke with President Biden's top Asia hand, Kirk Campbell. We talked about the historic summit at Camp David last Friday, with the presidents of South Korea and Japan. We also talked about China, China's economy, how China might view, you know, sort of the U.S. building up defensive alliances in the region. We talked about North Korea and the threat from its nuclear program. It was a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, Kurt is definitely at the center of things on Asia policy, and just a huge personality, good guy.
Can we call him a czar?
He's a czar. He's the Asia czar. He's the Indo-Pacific coordinator, which I think whenever the word coordinator is in your title,
makes you a bigger.
That's code for czar.
This is not just your
run-of-the-mill senior director here.
He's a BFD.
This is a czar.
And also just like a very funny guy who can tell a great story. Real quick before we get to the news, do yourself a solid and join the Friends of the Pod community. Before tonight's Republican debate, you will be able to hop in the Discord with us. It's a big, fun, rowdy chat room where we all laugh about what we're watching so we don't cry. You will also get bonus content, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, and much, much more. Early access to tickets for upcoming live shows in Louisville, San Diego, and San Jose. So go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe today. crooked.com/friends. Let's start with Ukraine, because you and I both noticed there's a bunch of reporting over the weekend or last couple days that was very similar about how the Ukrainian offensive is struggling. We both kind of wondered, like, was there a briefing? Like, what's going on here? Why are these all popping at the same time? Here's a few examples. The Financial Times, quote, U.S. officials are increasingly critical of Ukraine's counteroffensive strategy and gloomy about its prospects of success. Wall Street Journal, Russia's war on Ukraine is in danger of becoming a protracted struggle that lasts several more years. The Washington Post, Ukraine appears to be running out of options in a counteroffensive that officials originally framed as Kiev's crucial operation to retake significant territory. Post again, U.S. intelligence community assesses that Ukraine's counteroffensive will fail to reach the key southeastern city of Melitopol, blah, blah, blah. You get the point. We're not trying to be downers here. And like, obviously, like, the military situation can change quickly. We saw that last year in that offensive. But I do think the coverage in Washington is relevant, given that President Biden is asking for another $24 billion to arm Ukraine. That funding request is tucked into a broader funding package that includes disaster relief, border security, anti-drug stuff for fentanyl. So hopefully that makes the politics of voting against it harder. But Ben, I'm increasingly nervous about what Kevin McCarthy can or will be able to do when it comes to getting this passed.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't think we should be that surprised that this has been a hard fight. You know, we've talked a lot about how the Russians are dug in, how this is a bit of a war of attrition. From the get-go, you would think that this might be a multi-year war, not something that wraps in 2 years. I think the headline coming out of those stories, though, to me is a sense that the U.S. is in a different place from the Ukrainians. And so the subtext of the stories was not just that the Ukrainians are having trouble. It's that there's some disagreement on tactics and strategy between the Ukrainians and the Americans.
Yeah.
They really kind of boil down to a couple things. One thing that's been reported a lot in the last few weeks is that the Ukrainians tried out the kind of new you know, US and NATO trained approach to combined arms. And that's like, you know, trying to merge capabilities. You know, the Ukrainians would like more air capabilities, but tanks and some of the long range artillery and infantry capabilities. And instead, they've kind of, after suffering a lot of losses doing that, and not making a lot of territorial gains, they've kind of reverted back to like a grinded out artillery struggle.
Yep.
And that the U.S. would kind of like to see them make better use of all the weapons we're providing through these different tactics. Put that aside, because that's like, you know, the military experts can nerd out on that. The more fundamental thing that I saw in some of this reporting was the U.S. really wanting them to focus on just breaking this land bridge. The idea is that the Ukrainians are spread too wide. They're fighting on too many fronts.
Frankly, many guys in Bakhmut.
Yeah, this kind of comes out of the Bakhmut criticism. Why are you fighting in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine? You really have to focus on the south, because if you can kind of break the connection between Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the parts that Russia controls, that's what the U.S. really wants to keep Ukraine as a viable state. And the Ukrainians want to take back all their territory.
Yeah.
And to me, this is really important, because I don't think that the Biden administration believes that, they wouldn't say this, but that it's feasible in the near term that they're going to take back Crimea, they're going to take back every inch of eastern Ukraine.
No.
And so they would want Ukraine to throw everything at just kind of that, breaking that land bridge. That's a fundamental disconnect. And I think if you see the bad headlines, yes, that could lead to fatigue in Congress. That could be a rationale for people, and you already hear on the right, people saying, you know, why are we pouring weapons into this counteroffensive that's not making progress? But also it could create tensions between Washington and Kyiv, where if you see more grumbling like this from American officials, well, the Ukrainians are going to come out and say, we're the ones dying by the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Stop telling us what to do.
Right.
You know, and this kind of relationship that has worked pretty well thus far could get a little scratchy, and that would obviously be very counterproductive.
And to that end, Ben, I saw Jake Sullivan came out and briefed reporters today by the National Security Advisor. He said, we do not assess the conflict as a stalemate, which, you know, sort of counter to a lot of the reporting we've read. I guess maybe they mean Ukraine is making incremental progress. In slightly more positive news, the Washington Post reported that U.S. clustered munitions are proving highly effective in stopping Russian counterattacks, though they aren't necessarily helping the Ukrainians break through Russian lines. And yes, I'm very aware, listeners, of how depressing and gross it is to consider anything to do with clustered munitions to be positive. But like, this is a war and it's awful. Denmark and the Netherlands have agreed to provide Ukraine with F-16s, but that's obviously a ways off. As we discussed before, the U.S. and South Africa have been butting heads over the war for many months, especially after there's reports that South Africa was selling weapons to the Russians. This week, South Africa will host the annual BRICS summit, which brings together leaders from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. There's a lot of concern in Washington, I think, that Putin himself was going to fly to South Africa to attend this summit in person. But it turns out now he is going to Zoom in and avoid an ICC arrest warrant and, I guess, you know, not give the world the middle finger like an in-person visit would have done. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, reiterated that South Africa is not taking sides in the war. So it does seem like it's good, some good diplomatic work to get us back on sides a little bit with South Africa there. And then, Ben, you know, this isn't good news, but everyone's favorite insurrectionist warlord, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is in the Sahel region. He released a video saying he's going to make Russia great again. So, great.
Well, first of all, one other thing on the counteroffensive that occurs to me is that, and your point about the counteroffensive from the Russians brought this to mind, expectations were way too high for this counteroffensive at the beginning, right? And we were trying to throw cold water on this idea that they're going to like rout the Russians, and
right,
there was so much hype around this. And they may have, you know, inadvertently set expectations too high by talking about victory. They actually may be intentionally lowering expectations now. I think maybe the reason
it's
the U.S.
like the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the reason the U.S. and the Ukrainians might be backgrounding, oh, this counteroffensive isn't going well, so that when they do make some gains, but not, you know, enormous gains, it looks like a success. So that's one thing. On the BRICS summit, you know, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, it's pretty disappointing that, you know, almost 2 years into this full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that this entity, the BRICS, that Russia's at the center of, that's meant to be this kind of alternative world order to the U.S. institutions like the G7 and others, that it's, you know, it's still a hot ticket, you know, like in addition to the BRICS countries, other countries are being invited, and it's kind of meant to be this kind of parallel alternative world order. And so the fact that that is happening with Russian participation kind of indicates the degree to which it's just the kind of West that's seen the Ukraine war as this seismic shift in geopolitics. It's kind of business as usual for the BRICS countries and a lot of the others. And by the way, that includes like an India that was just given the red carpet treatment at the U.S. State visit. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the fact that Putin has to zoom in is an indication that something has changed.
It does diminish
him. Yeah, it diminishes him. Yeah. It makes him look, it reminds everybody.
We've all zoomed into the group meeting. You feel like an asshole. You're up on screen. You're talking over people. You never know who's in there, really.
We've zoomed in, but we've never zoomed in because the ICC had an arrest warrant out.
As far as you know.
So every time that people see Putin zooming in, it's kind of a reminder that, this guy is like a persona non grata in the international parts of the international community. So that's positive. The Prigozhin thing, though, does indicate that the Russian kind of bet on parts of Africa is still there. And we've been speculating that one of the reasons why Prigozhin's still alive is that he's the only guy who knows where the networks are in Africa, where the money trail is in Africa, who they're paying off. Yeah. And I think this video kind of confirms that. That like,
totally.
This guy is not in Belarus at some military camp just hanging out. This guy's back doing what he was unfortunately good at and indispensable to Putin at, which is kind of running coups and mercenaries and all manner of natural resource grabs in Africa. And I think that is problematic. The Wagner Group, a little bit of military expertise and hardware and willingness to use utter brute force can be very useful to a coup government in a place like Niger, as it was in Burkina Faso or Mali, but not good enough to fight jihadist networks that have made gains when Wagner replaces the U.S. or French. So something to watch here. Is this just PR from Prigozhin, or is this the start of another push by Wagner to take advantage of what's happening in Niger? I imagine, unfortunately, it's the latter.
Yeah, I think it's the latter, too. Yeah. And probably not hopeful news for those who want the coup resolved quickly or at all.
I guess his coup didn't work in Russia, but they could work more easily in Niger. Yeah.
Hope springs eternal when you're an insurrectionist. Let's switch gears to Saudi Arabia, Ben, because there was a horrible report released by Human Rights Watch on Monday, which says that Saudi security forces have murdered hundreds, maybe thousands of Ethiopian migrants attempting to enter Saudi Arabia from Yemen. This report says that Saudi border guards have been shooting migrants at close range, firing rocket launchers and mortars at groups of like hundreds of innocent people. It appears to be a policy of deliberately targeting migrants and asylum seekers with lethal force. Oftentimes, these groups are mostly made up of women and children. The report covers the period from March 2022 through June 2023. Human Rights Watch says the killings are still happening as we speak. Migrants who survive these attacks are often taken to detention centers where they are tortured. One survivor interviewed said that male migrants in this group were forced to rape teenage girls they were traveling with by these Saudi security forces, just like absolute sadists. One man who refused was murdered. An estimated 750,000 Ethiopians live and work in Saudi Arabia, but in recent years, many more have fled Ethiopia to escape the civil war or just sort of general economic challenges. The people who attempt this journey, they have to cross the Gulf of Aden. They're paying smugglers, they're paying human traffickers, and they're being abused by both the Saudi government and by the Houthi rebel groups in Yemen. Human Rights Watch gathered a ton of evidence for this report. They interviewed dozens of migrants or their relatives and friends, analyzed hundreds of photos and videos. They found satellite images of mass graves. So Ben, I mean, a couple thoughts. I hope the U.S. and every other country denounces this and pressures the Saudis to change this policy immediately. The UN should do some sort of investigation. I believe Human Rights Watch recommended that. And then finally, like, I don't think anyone should need another reminder of who Mohammed bin Salman is, but this is another reminder of who Mohammed bin Salman is and why the U.S. should probably not be cutting some diplomatic deal with the Saudis where we give them a security guarantee that's NATO-like or a nuclear program. It just doesn't seem like the best timing or the best idea to me. Call me crazy.
I think you put your finger on the most important thing, which is like, this is who the Saudi government is. This is who Mohammed bin Salman is. This wouldn't be happening. This isn't just a few excessive uses of force. This is clearly a systematic use of totally extrajudicial killing and torture and brutality. By the way, and at times to deal with migrants that like are a result of the Saudi war in Yemen, which mm-hmm. caused its own humanitarian crisis. What MBS is good at doing is we've talked about the sports washing. He's buying golf. He wants you to look at the line city, the weird thing
he'll
he's
never
building.
Get built, yeah, Neom
kind of,
or whatever.
Yeah, the kind of high, New York City High Line, except it goes on forever in Saudi Arabia. Or, you know, he'll make some change, like women can go to the movies or something, and everybody's like, oh, look at this guy. Right. He's changing Saudi society. He's a modernizer. Well, no, like he massacres people like this. One of the problems, ironically, tragically, of the Jamal Khashoggi crime is that it was so horrific to dismember this Washington Post journalist, but that kind of became, you know, like the one thing that everybody talked about. Like, how can we be, you know, buddies with this guy, MBS, who, you know, massacred Jamal Khashoggi? Well, he's also a guy that continues to systematically arrest and mistreat and intimidate any political opposition. They continue to not be anywhere near where they should be on basic things like women's rights. They continue to engage in wars in places like Yemen that have caused, you know, mass humanitarian crises. They continue to back warlords across the Middle East and North Africa, or military governance in places like Egypt that has been a disaster, or the guys in Sudan that, you know, they were kind of playing both sides, are now fighting civil war. Like, the Khashoggi is the tip of an iceberg in terms of this guy's human rights records, and all the sports washing and all the money and all the diplomatic dance around the Abraham Accords is meant to avert your gaze from this stuff.
Absolutely.
And so thank you to Human Rights Watch for documenting it. Tragically, usually it's worse than what they can uncover, because if, you know.
Oh, exponentially. Hundreds is what they can prove.
So imagine if that's what a human rights organization working that's not like literally on the ground in these prisons can see. Imagine what the broader reality is. So to me, like, we constantly have to be vigilant to not allow the kind of reputation laundering, whether it's diplomatic or sports or whatever else it is, to avert our gaze from like the true nature of what kind of leader MBS is. And at a certain point, to your point about this, the, you know, normalization deal, is this somebody that we want to be in business with permanently, saying that they're basically have the status of a NATO ally? Like, that, I don't know, this should make people deeply uncomfortable.
I also would love to know if any U.S. assistance is going to these units conducting these massacres, because that should trigger Leahy law provisions that would have to stop any support or cooperation, right?
That's a really good point. And also, part of the normalization talks are apparently mass amounts of increased arms sales too.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
So I, at a minimum, I hope that we're raising this diplomatically, yeah, in addition to publicly.
And Congress is too.
Yeah.
Staying in Saudi Arabia. So the foreign minister of Iran apparently traveled to Saudi Arabia last week for talks, including with MBS, the crown prince. After the meeting, Iranian state news reported that MBS had agreed to reciprocate the visit and will go to Tehran sometime in the future. It's a big deal because in 2016, Iran and Saudi Arabia broke off diplomatic relations. They agreed to restore them in March of this year in this sort of China-backed rapprochement. So, Ben, this is one of those weird stories where, like, obviously it would be great if Saudi Arabia and Iran could get along and not wage sort of constant proxy and covert wars against each other. But it also, again, I mean, makes it seem like a security guarantee for Saudi Arabia, which was mostly about deterring attacks from Iran, might be even less necessary than people are leading us to believe.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at MBS's behavior, it's like he's trying to close all the accounts, you know, like, you know, the normalization deal, get all this stuff from the U.S., like, patch it up. Or, I mean, I think he already gets along pretty well with Israel under the table, but like, normalize there, maybe diffuse things in Iran. But what it is it's kind of an axis of total autocracy, right? So the Iranians want a lifeline at a time when they're facing a protest movement. Maybe MBS wants this off his plate because he wants to be in a bigger weight class and fighting proxy wars with Iran. The Israelis, obviously, under Netanyahu and this kind of far-right government, stand to benefit. It feels like this is an effort to kind of close all the accounts and lock in the autocratic order in the region. And look, I'm glad they're talking. I'm glad that there's this. I'd rather the Saudis and Iranians are engaged in diplomacy. I would just hope that there's some space to even at least incrementally press on these values issues from the United States standpoint. They still need us a lot. And look, I think that this could probably also be a part of, you know, the U.S. and the West doing another nuclear deal, and the Saudis are more open to that because they have this line in with the Iranians. So there's good aspects to this from like a state-to-state diplomatic standpoint. The question is, what does it mean for the people in the region, whether you're like Iranian women or Saudi anybody who doesn't like MBS in Saudi Arabia or one of these migrants. And there, I think we just have to continue to try to press these issues.
Yeah. The person who's really benefiting the most from the Saudi relationship is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Because they continue to host LIV golf tournament events at his courses.
Not to mention our friend Jared Kushner, who's Jared, you know, sitting on a couple billion dollars.
Apparently not having much of a luck investing it.
Yeah. And but did you see, and something like 98% of his capital raise is outside the United States.
Of course. Yeah. Shocker. Yeah. Kickback. Speaking of Trump and his properties, there's a fun little twist in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. As I'm sure everyone remembers, Trump decided to take hundreds of classified documents with him from the White House to Mar-a-Lago and then store them by his toilet. The U.S. government shockingly didn't like that much. Trump now faces 40 separate criminal counts of stealing the documents and obstructing justice to get them back. Trump has, floated all these different reasons for what happened, including that he declassified all the documents before he left the White House. But according to a report from ABC News, that defense took a big hit when former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told prosecutors that he doesn't recall Trump ordering or even discussing declassifying broad sets of classified materials before leaving the White House, nor was there any standing declassification order. ABC News also reviewed an unpublished draft prologue from Meadows' book that came out last year that includes a description of Trump having a classified war plan sitting on his couch during a meeting attended by Meadows' ghostwriter and his publicist. Imagine being so fucking insecure as a former president that you just pretend you like left the Iran war plan on the couch. Like, this isn't a novel you were reading and put down to like answer the phone. It's like you're clearly placing that to try to impress these people.
First of all, it's amazing. This is, you know, there have been so many other indictments that we forget. This is such an open and shut case.
Truly.
Every couple of weeks, like some other piece of information comes out that's like, not only did you do these crimes, here's like nine more independent corroborations of the exact thing.
Here's some
like,
texting Ivanka. Yeah, hey, I did
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, here's the Iranian war plan, like, you know, like being passed around a Mar-a-Lago wedding.
On his
or something.
Christmas
you
know? Card. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And so you would like, if we had like the right judge on this one, maybe this is the one that could move fastest.
Tough, I know.
I also like the Mark Meadows piece of this is really telling because, first of all, just to take it substantively, if you wanted to declassify, you would have to tell somebody that. Now, Trump has given this crazy Sean Hannity interview where he said he could like think something is declassified. And that. No, there's a process.
He's the mentalist, yeah.
And the process would be you'd have to tell the chief of staff or the national security advisor or the director of national intelligence, hey, I'd like to declassify these documents, because then they run a process to do that. And that clearly didn't happen here, you know, and that matters for the prosecution that he has no basis to make this argument whatsoever, you know, and even Meadows seemed to understand this. I continue to be interested in like who the audience is for these Mark Meadows books, you know, like because he has his own book, which I didn't even realize had come out because it kind of came and went.
I do love Mark Meadows as kind of like the bumbling Forrest Gump of the Trump orbit, who's just like bumbles his way into criminal activity and getting his boss in trouble left and right.
Turning over
his texts and then being like, oh, I didn't want to do that. Can I have them back? And the prosecutor's like, no, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so this book is called The Chief's Chief, which I...
What?
I'm just going to own up to the fact that I haven't read it. But I don't even know what that means, you know. But like these guys, like Meadows and Pompeo and Mick Mulvaney, you know, like these guys were like the complete lunatic fringe when they were elected to Congress and like, you know, the Tea Party election, trying to present themselves as these more reasonable guys. But like Meadows at every turn made all the wrong decisions. At best, he did nothing. At worst, he was enabling all of this behavior. Like if you were the former chief of staff, like a Dennis McDonough, right? Our former boss, chief of staff, very strickler to the rules, right? Mm-hmm. If Dennis McDonough came to my house and after we left government and saw like the classified Iran war plan there.
He might kill you.
I don't think he would just like observe it.
No.
And then be like, oh, maybe that's a good anecdote to drop in my prologue of
like,
my book.
Hey, you Buster, we're going
to
burn that.
Yeah, it goes to show like all these people were just so casual about national security and about criminality, you know, that his thought process on seeing the classified Iran war plan isn't like, hey, maybe we should shred that thing or better off return it. It's like, this could be maybe sell a few books by dropping in the prologue.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that Dennis would obstruct justice. I meant to imply that he would dispose of it in the proper way.
And dispose of us, you know.
Dispose of us in the proper way. Dennis, the nicest guy in the world who emailed us both yesterday to make sure we were okay. Los Angeles had a hurricane.
Survived the hurricane, which was, you know, it was 24 hours of rain, but we did.
Yeah, speaking of LA hurricanes, let's talk about climate change, Ben.
Ah, good.
Two pieces of good news for people who are worried about climate change. First, Ecuadorians overwhelmingly voted to ban oil drilling in a national park situated in the Amazon rainforest. So the vote was 59% said no oil drilling, 41% said yes, so pretty overwhelming. The Yasuni National Park spans about 2.5 million acres, and it's one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, so good to preserve that. Also, data released last month shows that deforestation in Brazil's Amazon fell 34% in the first half of 2023, thanks to Brazilian President Lula da Silva's environmental policies. So will either of those stories solve the problem? Of course not. Far from it. But it does show how important political decisions and political leadership can be, especially everybody who worked hard to get fucking Jair Bolsonaro tossed out in Brazil.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Latin America is going to be absolutely fundamental to preventing the kind of deforestation that could make any effort to mitigate climate change impossible. You know, Southeast Asia, Latin America. And these are countries where, like you said, it's not like the negotiation that happens at the COP that is doing this. It is the politics in these countries that matter. And so, like, the people that care about climate change have to care about politics everywhere.
Yes.
Like significantly in the United States too.
Yeah.
Like if you care about climate and you're like some big philanthropist, well, maybe you should be thinking about political outcomes as much as, you know, financing, you know, some, you know, well-meaning NGO. I mean, we need to do that too. Don't get me wrong.
Do
both is the point. And I think what's also important here is that, you know, you hear a lot from Brazilians, they don't want to be told what to do with the Amazon. It's like a precious resource to them. So there has to be kind of a partnership in trying to help them find solutions rather than coming in and being like, here's what you do. And this is an indication that they understand what the value of those resources are. And with the right political leadership, it makes a huge difference.
And you got to make it make economic sense, right? You got to tell Ecuador, look, ecotourism is going to benefit you much more in the long run than clear cutting this place and drilling.
Yeah.
You know, and that could be a tough sell, but I think it worked here.
And it does also show like the connection between politics on democracy and climate, which we've talked about a bit, which is that, you know, Bolsonaro is like an autocratic, self-interested nationalist. He's opened it up to all the loggers and people probably like, you know, making corrupt deals to get in the Amazon. Like, so, you know, having more small D democratic leaders winning in places is also good for the earth.
Yeah, huge deal. Okay, here's some bad news for climate change. So Canada has been dealing with massive, unprecedented fires this year, wildfires. It started with this dry and abnormally warm spring. That meant the fires started earlier and they've spread ever since. The Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center says 1,037 fires were burning as of Monday, and well over half of them were considered out of control. Smoke from fires in British Columbia and also Washington and Oregon have blanketed the Pacific Northwest with smoke. Tens of thousands of people in Canada are under evacuation alerts or evacuation orders because fires have gotten so close to population centers. British Columbia is under a state of emergency. Prime Minister Trudeau said he's going to deploy the military to help people get out of there. Trudeau is also hammering Facebook. Do you see this?
Yeah.
Meta. For blocking news content.
Meta,
I'm not using your dumb terms. Yeah. Facebook.
Twitter and Facebook, guys.
For blocking news content in Canada. So earlier this summer, Facebook started blocking news content from Canada on its platforms because Canada passed a law requiring technology companies to pay publishers when they link to or repurpose their content. Seems reasonable. Trudeau said, quote, "Right now, in an emergency situation where up-to-date local information is more important than ever, Facebook is putting corporate profits ahead of people's safety." We should note that Google also said they're going to remove Canadian news links in response to this law, but they haven't done it yet. So, Ben, familiar story here, climate change leading to severe weather, horrible fires, and also tech companies being assholes.
Well, and this is a good example, too, of like, you know, some of these tech companies, you know, make donations to environmental causes. But then when their profit margin is impacted at all, it's not like Google or Meta, whatever you want to call it, are going to have some huge hit because of this Canadian law. Like,
no,
come on.
They're trying to draw a line in the sand for others. Yeah.
Do the right thing. The one thing I will say is this cries out for kind of a regional effort because do you remember the North American Leaders Summit?
Oh, how could I forget?
NALS,
of course.
An acronym that nobody is aware of, which is essentially the leaders of the US, Canada, and Mexico would meet once a year and you'd work on issues. It does feel to me like when you do have a good relationship like the US and Canada do, we should be looking at like a North American climate, you know, policy that would include significant amount of U.S. resources being available to deal with things like Canadian wildfires. Yeah. We just have a lot more capacity. We have a huge defense budget, obviously, some of which could be relevant here. So one thing that I think the U.S. and Canada can do is try to kind of harmonize an approach to wildfires. Look, I was in New York this summer, and I was having trouble breathing because of Canadian wildfires.
It's horrible.
So there's a U.S. interest in spending some resources on a North American approach to mitigate wildfires.
Absolutely.
That's the kind of future we're going into with this extreme weather. There's going to have to be cross-border cooperation, not just on emissions reduction, but on all this kind of climate mitigation.
Totally agree with that. Let's turn to Ecuador, because people in Ecuador went to the polls over the weekend to vote in presidential and legislative elections. Last week, we talked about the shocking assassination of a candidate named Fernando Villavicencio as he was exiting a campaign event. Luisa Gonzalez, the candidate from the Democratic Socialist Party, got the most votes with 33% in the elections. She is seen as a protege of former president Rafael Correa, who is living in exile in Belgium after being convicted of bribery. She will face off against a 35-year-old member of Ecuador's National Assembly named Daniel Noboa, who got 24%. He's more of a centrist. He's the son of a rich banana business guy who also has run for president before. All of these candidates were incredibly on edge during voting, obviously, because one of their rivals had just gotten assassinated. Ecuador also said that there were cyber attacks on their elections from a number of countries, but the results were not impacted. Regardless, the two leaders will go head-to-head in a runoff in October. The winner will hold office until 2025 because the outgoing president called for early elections. So that's the latest from Ecuador.
Yeah. And look, it took a lot of courage for these people to just kind of keep campaigning.
Can you imagine?
And so to me, it is a sign of some resilience of democracy here, even if, you know, the people that killed a candidate kind of made their point too, right? But I think you did see most of the political class in Ecuador stand up against this kind of thing. And there was kind of some defiance and resiliency, which is, I think, positive here. It does certainly feel like the left of center candidate has the upper hand. We were talking also, Tommy, about the election in Guatemala.
Oh, right, yeah, of course.
Where you had, like, out of nowhere, you know, you had the political elite try to kind of strangle, you know, ban candidates. And you had the outsider candidate, the progressive candidate, the anti-corruption candidate, Bernardo Arevalo, come out of nowhere and win this election, a real glimmer of hope in Central America, where the politics has been, let's just say, not great between Bukele in El Salvador and Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. This is worth noting as like a real win for democracy and anti-corruption and progressive values against long odds. And frankly, you're kind of drawing the short straw if you kind of walk in that viper's nest of like corruption and money.
For short term too, yeah.
Yeah, but this is definitely a good outcome.
Yeah, so you brought us up. I'm going to bring us back down by talking about the far right in Germany. We often talk about the rise of these far right political parties, especially right-wing populists. One such party is the Alternative for Germany, or AfD party. AfD is virulently extreme and right-wing, anti-LGBT. They want to deport migrants. They talk about openly preferring like a Trumpian style of communications. They talk about the great replacement theory all the time. According to the Washington Post, the AfD is now polling at around 21%, making it the second most popular party in Germany. They are riding economic concerns, anger about immigration, and it is creating this sort of political conundrum for the center-right Christian Democratic Party, as they have to decide, do we work with these people, right, and try to like siphon off some of their support? Do you ostracize them? So, you know, it's like a classic conundrum that people deal with when managing the far right. So it's worrisome to have these far right parties doing well, especially in Germany of all places. And the other part about this that is this different in Germany is the AfD is gaining more support while becoming more radical. They're not moderating to gain support like you saw in, you know, Italy, for example. And so, you know, this isn't like, this is not an unfamiliar feeling for us in America, where we watched the Republican Party win elections by becoming more radical in 2016. But it is concerning. And by the way, it's connected to all the other things we talked about, like support for Ukraine, climate change, immigration, like all the broader systemic problems.
Yeah, never good when the Nazis get like a foothold in Germany.
Don't love that.
Yeah, I mean, that the AfD, you know, has deep roots in kind of neo-Nazi far-right ideology, and they've been lingering around, but they've usually kind of hit 5-10% ceiling. And so this nudging up it should be seen as a big warning sign. And look, we've taken issue with, made fun of, and we'll probably do it again with Vivek in a few minutes here, these critiques of the Ukraine war. But the reality is, part of what is happening is you had this massive energy disruption, you've had cost of living crises, you have lots of refugees from Ukraine now in Germany, and that does present a set of challenges. And just because, that doesn't mean that therefore we should withdraw support for Ukraine, and but sometimes people don't want to talk about those challenges because they think just talking about those challenges somehow delegitimizes support for Ukraine. No, I think it's very important to name these issues and to have European leaders close to public opinion on this stuff. I think Olaf Scholz has done a pretty good job as Chancellor of Germany, but clearly there needs to be constant effort to kind of name the anxieties that people are feeling in Europe, so that you don't have a set of politicians who are like, no, we're doing the right thing, nothing to see here. And then the radicals seem like the ones who are telling the truth, Yeah. And so I think a much more kind of honest, close to the ground conversation about politics in all these countries is going to be necessary, or else we could look up in a few years and you get the National Front in France and Meloni in Italy, and maybe the AfD is not in charge, but they suddenly
a big player in a coalition.
They've knocked down the door. This is something you really got to nip in the bud.
It's worrisome. Yeah. It's worrisome. So you mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy. The first Republican debate is happening on Wednesday, August 23rd. We record this the day before, so we don't know what's going to be discussed. But it seems like Ramaswamy is going to come under attack for some recent comments he made about Israel. Here's a clip.
I'm a deal maker, okay? I want to negotiate now Abraham Accords 2.0. Get Saudi, Oman, Qatar, Indonesia in there. Get Israel on its own 2 feet. And I believe in standing by commitments that we've already made. So our commitments have, I think, $38 billion in aid, military support, et cetera, going in through 2028. I want to get Israel to the place where it is negotiated back into the infrastructure of the rest of the Middle East. We should not be worried about holding one nation or one region hostage over one particular question relating to Palestine. Go to Abraham Accords 2.0. That's good for Israel. It's good for the rest of the Middle East. It's good for us, such that come 2028, that additional aid won't be necessary in order to still have the kind of stability that we'd actually have in the Middle East by having Israel more integrated in with its partners.
He made these comments on Russell Brand's show on Rumble. Yes, the guy from Get Him to the Greek is doing presidential interviews. So Nikki Haley, former ambassador to the UN under Trump, came out swinging at Vivek. She said he is completely wrong to call for ending America's special bond with Israel. Support for Israel is both the morally right and strategically smart thing to do. And if elected president, I will never abandon Israel. In response to Haley, Vivek's spokesperson said, "We wish her well on her future in corporate America's boardrooms." Great hit. But then Mark Levin, who's this very popular conservative radio host, also criticized him. Vivek responded more substantively, saying he will accomplish the Abraham Accords 2.0 in his first year, which means Israel will be fully integrated into the region, so they will have all the support it needs. It's just like, it's classic Vivek Ramaswamy policy, and then it's all 4 or 5D chess, and he talks about incredibly hard things as if they are simple. But it is a pretty radical departure from the orthodoxy in either party when it comes to aid to Israel.
Yeah. First of all, I love that guy's verbal tics, which we talked about last week. He's like, it's such self-assurance, which kind of makes it hard to not think like, well, does this guy know what he's talking about? So you see why he's kind of catching on a little bit, because he says things with such absolute assurance. To me, what was interesting about this is a couple of things. First of all, the substance of what he said should actually not be, basically what he's saying is, if Abraham Accords 2.0, as he brands it, is Israel's basically normalized relations with everybody and given nothing to the Palestinians and can kind of crush them, then why do we need to give them $4 billion in military assistance a year?
It's not an unreasonable question.
I don't even support the—
A lot of ifs,
yeah,
right?
I don't even support the Abraham Accords 2.0, but if you follow his logic train, I actually don't know that Nikki Haley it has her finger on the pulse of the Republican voter on this one either,
right? I don't think she does at all,
like,
no.
I think he's breaking the wall. Like, the Democratic Party's had this debate. I think what he's doing is he's signaling that this is probably a debate that's coming to the Republican Party too, you know? And for some good reasons, substantive reasons, like why are we giving a wealthy country that is a regional military superpower $4 billion a year in military aid? Probably some not good reasons too, like some of that MAGA base has probably, you know, some of them are evangelicals who want the Jews to convert at the rapture.
Yeah.
Some of them may, you know, they like George Soros dog whistles and, you know, like what Vivek is saying for bad reasons. I think one of the things that was most interesting to me, Tommy, is like the way this was received. The New York Times, so I'm, I don't know if I'm picking on the New York Times or the Nature of American Politics or who.
Pick away.
But they have a paragraph here that said, opponents have attacked Mr. Ramaswamy for his assertions that he would leave Taiwan to the Chinese once the United States has sufficiently expanded its semiconductor industry. He would allow Russia to keep parts of Ukraine in order to entice Vladimir Putin away from his alliance with China. Then he said he would curtail military aid to Israel after stabilizing the Middle East, perhaps the politically riskiest position yet. That's a crazy sentence.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and yeah. Maybe this is not a shot at the Times. It's more a shot at like how the perceptions of foreign policy become received wisdom. Is it more controversial to suggest we should not give $4 billion a year to Israel than it is to say that China can have Taiwan?
To let two democracies be crushed.
And Russia can have Ukraine. Yeah. Like, that, there's something wrong with the politics of foreign policy when that is a normal sentence, right?
Yeah, I had not read that.
Yeah,
like that is really troubling.
And I know what the Times is reflecting.
I do too,
it's not just the Times, but it's like, you know, I don't think this is sustainable, this idea that you can't even broach these issues, you know? I think this debate about aid is coming. The 10-year memorandum of understanding that guides U.S. military aid to Israel is expiring soon. And I'm not sure. I think there are going to be people in both parties who are going to be like, are we signing up for another $40 billion, $50 billion in aid to a country that really doesn't need it? And some of them are telling us they don't want it because that's mainly aid that gets channeled through U.S. defense contractors. So anyway, I hate to say Vivek has a take that is worth consideration. It's a stop clock that is right periodically, but you know, he's stirring a pot that I think is going to be stirred increasingly.
It is interesting. Here's one other clip of him talking about the United Nations, speaking of pot stirring.
I think we need to stop funding organizations that are hostile to the sovereignty of the US. That includes the WHO. That may very well include the UN. I am perfectly open to reevaluating the U.S.'s continued involvement in the U.N. itself, if the U.N. Security Council is staffed by the likes of Venezuela and North Korea, it is a joke. And we have to call out that farce for what it is. I've already said I would shut down the CDC. That's on my list of three-letter agencies that I would shut down here in the United States here at home. And my general view, this is, I'm only saying half jokingly here, but if it comes in an acronym, chances are we should be skeptical of it.
He wants to, like, shut down half of the government. It is far more radical, the things he's saying about like getting rid of the CDC. I think he wants to shut down the FBI. I forget, maybe the EPA. Like, there's all these acronyms, agencies that he just wants to get rid of.
I mean, the WHO stuff is insane. Like, we benefit from the WHO. Like, do we not want any international effort to prevent pandemics?
I don't like diseases.
Yeah. Like, what personally would happen if there's an Ebola outbreak? You know, who do you think we call in the international system? On the UN point, is weird to me. I get why Vivek, you know, it's an easy
kind of like an old school John Bolton
but
type comment.
That's what's interesting to me about Vivek is like doing this is that's kind of like retro. That's like 20 years ago. Like, the UN is really, does anybody think the UN is the problem? Like, the problem in the UN right now is that Russia and China are paralyzing it.
Yeah.
So like, the reason the Security Council isn't able to solve any problems isn't because it's quote unquote staffed by Venezuelans and North Koreans. I didn't know what the fuck he's talking about there.
They need some woke reason it's a problem, or some communist reason that's really the problem, when really, you know, it's Russia and China.
Yeah, and the Republicans are the dog that caught the car on this one, because they've demagogued the UN for so long, but now it's the Russians and Chinese who are like, hey, the UN headquartered in New York City with a bunch of rules that were written by the United States is basically, in their view, an extension of the West. And so therefore, we're going to have our own BRICS thing. So Vivek saying he's going to break the UN is kind of like breaking the pieces of the international system that we fucking built. Yeah. You know?
These guys want to get rid of all the institutions that benefit U.S. security, like NATO as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's a self-own, like all these things that these people want to do.
Totally.
He's giving Taiwan to the Chinese. He's giving Ukraine to the Russians. He's blowing up the U.N., which is something the Russians and Chinese want. Like, maybe start to... time to ask questions with this 6 month crash course he's been on seems to really benefit the wrong people.
Who was your teacher, sir? Well, please fill us in.
Tucker Carlson,
I guess. Tucker. Yeah. It probably was Tucker. So Ben, last week, an unmanned Russian spacecraft crash landed into the moon. The Luna 25 probe was Russia's first lunar mission to the moon in nearly 50 years. It was designed to check out the lunar South Pole because scientists think there might be a bunch of ice there, which would be critical in terms of a water supply and oxygen supply for supporting life on the moon in the future. India also launched a lunar mission. It is supposed to land on Wednesday, August 23rd, so the day this comes out. If the mission is a success, it would obviously be a feather in the cap for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and a bit humiliating for the Russians since they launched their probe early because they wanted to beat India to the moon, to the lunar South Pole. So Ben, I'm sure there are like some resistance accounts that are like dunking on this on Twitter and cheering about Russia's failure. And I get that, right? I mean, you don't want anything that sort of benefits Putin as a PR win is probably not great right now. But bigger picture and long term, it would be great for all of us to work together on space exploration and not have to rely on assholes like Elon Musk or, not have a plan B if the planet burns.
I mean, if I'm Russian, I'm like, all right, we're already like our economy is in the shitter because of this stupid fucking war. We're dealing with sanctions. We're spending all this money in Ukraine. And why are we landing something on the moon? Like, it just shows the megalomania of Putin. Like, I just think this should be a vulnerability for him. Like, what's the point of doing moon missions? And also, this kind of weird space race to get to the moon, I'll be a little jingoistic here. Like, we had guys, like, hitting golf balls on the moon when, like, you know, Johnny Carson was hosting the Tonight Show. Like, I mean, or decades before. I wish we could cooperate more and, like, achieve international aims in space rather than have this kind of weird retro space race. You know?
Yeah, it is crazy. What was that great? One of my favorite attacks on Barack Obama ever. One of the dumbest quotes I've ever read.
How are you going to teach our kids to reach for the stars when you're cutting funding for the very same things allow them to
RNC spokesman Danny Diaz said, "It is ironic that Barack Obama's plan to help our children reach for the stars is financed in part by slashing a program that helps us learn about those very same stars."
It was a quaint time when politics was about issuing statements that appealed to swing states. Meant to appeal to Florida because we were cutting some launch pad in Florida.
Incredible. Last story before we get to the interview. So we need to talk about diplomacy, dining, and dashing, Ben. So here's the backstory. Four Italian tourists went to Albania. They had a nice dinner. They purportedly enjoyed the food. And then they ran out of there without paying the check. They were caught on security video. And the clip blew up on social media. It became such big news that the prime minister of Albania raised this exact issue with Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni while she was visiting Albania. Meloni responded by telling the Italian ambassador to Albania to, quote, "go and pay the bill for these idiots," end quote. And she sent this guy over to the restaurant and they picked up the 80 euro tab. So Ben, to me, this is a reminder that you might be a bit of a fascist, you might be a fan of a Mussolini, but you can also be pretty good at politics. And that's shrewd.
That is really good at politics, I have to say. I mean, it's a dumb thing because like people run on the check everywhere and it doesn't have to be an international incident, but I get that the Albanians feel like, you know, that's the Italians looking down on them. So
exactly.
That's, you know, there's a reason why she's very good at politics. I think she's, you know, I don't agree with her politics, but I think she's going to be around for a little while.
I do too. The New York Times had an interesting profile on her recently. It was also featured on The Daily. They talked about some of the ways she seems to have moderated.
Yeah.
They are kicking out the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative programs. They are seemingly a lot less anti-EU. She's not yanking support out from under the Ukrainians yet. So she's turned out to be more complicated, I think, than we thought she might
she's
be.
She's like maintains her far right view of immigration. And I think what she's calculated is that's the bread and butter for my base.
Yeah.
And these other areas I can give in ways that help me because it's better for her to not be ostracized.
She got invited to Washington.
Yeah exactly. Right?
Okay, well, that is it for us for the news. When we take a quick break and then we're going to come back, you'll hear my interview with President Biden's top Asia hand, Kirk Campbell, about their recent summit at Camp David. So stick around for that. I am so excited to welcome to the show my friend and President Biden's coordinator for Indo-Pacific Affairs, Kirk Campbell. Kurt, it's great to see you.
Tommy, it's great to see you as well. I wish I was there with you in person.
I wish you were here too. But you've been a busy man. Last week, President Biden hosted the presidents of Japan and South Korea at Camp David for this historic summit. Historic because you guys hashed out a new defense agreement and because there has been some longstanding animosity between Japan and South Korea. Can you tell us a bit about how this came together and what you guys accomplished?
Sure. Thank you. And Tommy, it's a great way to begin. So first of all, our two closest allies in Asia, or certainly in Northeast Asia, Japan and South Korea, each ally like nearly 80 years old. And we're very close, and we have a security commitment to both of them. The challenge has been during the Second World War and before, obviously, Japan occupied South Korea, a brutal colonial experience, and also tough fighting during the Second World War. I think it'd be fair to say that neither country really fully recovered from that experience. And so for decades, there have been start and stop efforts to try to rebuild trust and confidence. Each time that you might see a little bit of progress, then you'd see backtracking. So basically, when President Biden came to office, he had tried working on this himself when he was vice president. Tommy, and you recall when you were working with President Biden, and I remember him leaving the room singing, man, those guys don't like each other. And so when he first came to power here as president, he instructed us to basically work behind the scenes, do what's possible to try to bring these two really treasured allies more closely together. So we had a series of interactions, mostly private, some trilateral, kind of behind the scenes, shuttling, trying new ideas, new concepts. But it wasn't until we had new leadership in both Japan and South Korea. South Korea in particular, President Yoon, elected last year, has taken heroic, courageous steps, basically to underscore his commitment and Korea's commitment to mending fences and moving forward with Japan. And Japan, under Prime Minister Kishida, I think carefully has responded. So what we saw last week was an effort to take this fledgling bipartisan sort of agreement between these two countries into a trilateral context. So we rolled out all these things that our three countries will do together in an attempt to lock in that cooperation and to place the United States at the center of this engagement. Now, Tommy, you were at Camp David many times. This was only my second time there. Terribly exciting, you know, really wonderful to see my Japanese and South Korean friends there with the president. I think everyone felt that it was tremendously significant. And, you know, the word historic is thrown around a lot, but I think it'd be fair to say this was historic.
Yeah, I think you emphasized something there, which is this meeting and these tough conversations are very difficult politics for both of these leaders back home. So it's a courageous political decision. They allowed my ass at Camp David one time. It was in 2012, and they said, please don't come back. This was the G8, now the G7. My memories of it are watching soccer with a bunch of the leaders of the Champions League final. And then Dmitry Medvedev was there. It was his last hurrah on the world stage until he and his entourage were pushed out by Vladimir Putin. So I remember he and his crew got shit-faced until 2 in the morning, and then I think they tried to order 27 hamburgers from the Navy mess. So did you guys get into any creative diplomacy or get in any trouble?
Most of what we're involved with in staff is stealing as much shit as possible. And so I didn't have as much time to drink because I came home and my wife said, like, Kurt, you've got 700 notepads. I'll be able to write a note every day for the rest of my life. So we have shirts, notepads, everything possible. We bought lots of stuff that I will never wear. None of my kids will wear, but it just felt so exciting to be there. We had to have things that we would take.
Yeah, you got to take the tchotchkes. Yeah. Okay, allow me to pretend to be a hard-ass journalist
for
a second.
Okay, go ahead.
So imagine, you know, China's military buildup was probably a big you know, yeah. part of the conversation. If you and I were sitting in Beijing, we might say, look at these goddamn Americans. They are giving nuclear subs to the Australians. They're shipping weapons to Taiwan. They're hosting this summit. They're trying to contain us, right? They're driving this arms race and they're doing it all to check us. What's your response to that?
Well, look, you know, we're obviously, Tommy, in an action and reaction cycle. I would simply say you forgot to mention the Quad, other things that we're doing in the Philippines. So you're right. They have a very established narrative of all the things that we are purportedly doing to keep them down. I will simply say that probably no country has done more to support China's rise, help with investment and capacity and know-how than the United States. And almost every country in the Indo-Pacific wants a predictable, stable relationship between their country and China. So I just begin with that as a proposition. I think what we've seen over the course progressively of the last 10 years is a leader in Xi Jinping that is increasingly ambitious, prepared to take risks, believes that the United States is in just profound decline and that it's China's time to basically strike on the international scene. And I think our response would be not so fast, and that the United States has worked with allies and partners to, Tommy, essentially construct what we might describe as an operating system in the Indo-Pacific. And that operating system has yielded unprecedented prosperity. We've lifted billions of people out of poverty. We've kept peace and stability. And this fabric of maintenance of peace and stability, peaceful resolution of disputes, maritime security, there are many elements that go into this. But almost every state that we've engaged believes that there are aspects of this operating system that are essential. And what China's trying to do as an arriving state, sorry to go international relations on you. Is trying to revise that system in ways that frankly are not in the interests of these countries. So I think what we are seeing is a response to China. I do not believe that this is a noose around China's neck. None of these countries want to contain China. They want to have good relations with China, but they are worried about the direction that China's policy has taken over the last several years. And they look to the United States to be stable, firm, clear, and tough.
Yeah. Xi Jinping is going to build an island off the coast of Delaware and blame it on you, pal. So in their one and only Oval Office meeting after Trump won the election, President Obama reportedly warned him that the threat from North Korea was urgent, that their nuclear weapons program was something he needed to get on top of. Of course, we're sitting here 6 years later. Yeah. North Korea's got more nukes. They got better missiles. I believe they're able to launch them from subs now, despite all of Trump's, you know, let's call it creative efforts at diplomacy. Do you think it's time to admit that we are not going to put the toothpaste back in the tube here and that North Korea will never give up its nukes?
So I'm still about trying to get that toothpaste back in the tube. It's a thankless task. But I will say, since President Biden has come to office, his determination has been to do whatever possible to reach out without condition to make clear that we want to resume a dialogue and work constructively with North Korea. Look, Tommy, I will tell you this, that, you know, when COVID struck North Korea, we were terribly worried that this would lead to, you know, enormous human consequences. We offered vaccines. We offered support behind the scenes very carefully, not done for publicity or propaganda purposes, but to hopefully signal our genuine desire to support and help the people of North Korea. Essentially, since President Trump stormed out of Hanoi now 7 years ago, we've really had no engagement with North Korea, but we are not alone. Japan, South Korea, other countries have also tried. They are simply, I think, in the current context, working closely with China in a few things, practicing some military tests, and essentially unhappy with the status quo in Northeast Asia. We're going to continue to engage. Our response to North Korean provocations is what you saw in Camp David last week: solidarity, a sense of a common purpose between our allies and partners in Northeast Asia.
I know you got to go soon, so let's try one last question. I assume you have a, you know, you're probably going to go to a meeting where you try to deal with the North Korean nuclear program or something. Ben and I noticed that Joe Biden at a fundraiser likes to talk about China. He recently called the Chinese economy a ticking time bomb in many cases. He said they've got some problems. That's not good because when bad folks have problems, they do bad things. Ben and I kind of wondered if this was maybe, I don't know, an intelligence assessment. And there was a sense that like, Xi Jinping might, you know, see this massive youth unemployment. They might see this looming economic crisis with this kind of ghost real estate bubble that's been built up and think, I don't know, one way to distract from that is to make a move on Taiwan. Is that something folks should be concerned about?
So, look, I think the truth is that we're still trying to understand, Tommy, what's happening in the Chinese economy. You pointed to a couple of things that were tracking closely: youth unemployment, the property bubble, some issues associated with debt, not only at the national level, but at local levels as well. The Chinese economy has slowed down substantially. The government has taken steps that, in many respects, we believe undermine innovation. They've made it illegal to talk about just data in the economy as a national security threat. So there are many things that are going on in China that are impeding growth, that are causing the wheels, if not to come off, certainly to slow down substantially with respect to Chinese economic performance. The question is always in that environment, if you are facing domestic headwinds and challenges, does that cause you to be less ambitious internationally, to hedge your bets, to be more careful? Or does it cause you to think about, look, we've got to distract attention and take steps that would lead to more provocative actions? And I don't think we really know the answer now. And the truth is, you can see, you know, one strategy followed for a while and then suddenly the other. And so I think it requires the United States to be deeply focused, to remain vigilant, to work with China where we can, which we're determined to do, and work closely. As we speak, Tommy, it was just announced that our very able Commerce Secretary Raimondo will be in China next week. We are keeping those lines of communication open. In truth, I think no one would have expected that the U.S. economy post-COVID would be booming and China would be facing challenges. But it is a lesson that those who underestimate the United States do so at their own peril.
Well, Kurt, I want to tell you that one, Ben and I pledge that if we see one of those spy balloons over Los Angeles, we'll shoot it down ourselves. And two, you know, congratulations on the summit. I can only imagine how many hours you guys spent in the Situation Room preparing for this thing. It must have been an ungodly amount of work.
So it was a lot of work, but blowing up those balloons also, your arm muscles get really tired.
Awesome. Well, listen, thanks again. And it was great having you on. Let's do it again soon.
Great. Say hello to everyone for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Kurt for joining the show. Don't dine and dash, people. It's just a dick move.
You know, okay, I did this once.
How old were you?
I was like 17. Uh-huh. There was like an all-night diner that you could go to like drunk at 2 a.m. and get like eggs.
Where are we?
We're on the Upper West Side.
Okay.
And I had like a couple of meathead friends who I think had done this once before, and mm-hmm. I was uncomfortable with it, but they're like, we got to do it, you know. It was really stupid because we go to that place all the time, so like I think that the idea is like we were gonna end up paying these people anyway at some point. Let's just say, like, we all run out. The guy who chases us decides to follow me.
Oh no!
I was fast. I thought they'd go after the slower guys, but I think he wanted to go after the faster guy.
Oh no!
And he like kicked my ass.
Oh,
like,
no, really?
He drop kicked me. Like, he fucking drop kicked me.
Was it literally kicked you in the ass?
Literally kicked me in the ass.
Okay.
I was like, I'm sorry, it wasn't my idea. Here's money. Like, you know, and you know what? Good on that
lesson
guy.
Lesson learned. Yeah.
I like my brief career in, you know, petty whatever.
Petty theft.
You know, the $5 I owed for this eggs and hash browns I paid and I deserved it. So, like, good on that guy for kicking my ass, literally.
I'm trying to think if I ever dined and dashed. I don't think I ever did. I have a really well-developed sense of guilt, and I'm not that fast.
I was pained with guilt, like just, I remember feeling guilty before this even happened. So I was like secretly, I think, felt like I got what I deserved when this guy was like literally drop kicking me.
Have you ever been to the grocery store and they sell like lemon looking plastic things that squeeze out lemon juice?
Yes, of course.
I remember for some reason, I was like 6 or 7 and I went to the grocery store with my mom. I stole one of those. We got home. She was like, where the hell did you get that? And I was like, I stole it. She threw me right back in the car and we returned it. So I think that was an early terrifying lesson.
I had to do that once with my daughter because she, when she was like 2, she would ride in the cart and she just, I guess, had grabbed a lime and was just like holding it. And I get out in the parking lot. I'm like, what? Wait, I don't think we paid for that lime, you know? Like,
yeah, we got to teach
so
the
I
rule.
Returned. I did return it.
If you eat it in the store, it's okay.
Yeah, it's a reminder. I guess, you know, the produce is easy to swipe if you're 2, you know? Yeah.
And I think we returned it. The person was like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah,
I just work here,
yeah, take the lime.
I don't own Roach Brothers. What are we doing?
Although at the Erewhon in Venice, that lime probably costs like $5.
$400.
So I returned it. I returned it to people.
God help. If you try to go to an Erewhon in this city and you make a smoothie with a couple different parts to it, you're paying $200 minimum. Yeah. Anyway, enough about LA problems. That's it for us this week. Talk to you guys next week.
See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Michael Martinez. Our associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Phoebe Bradford, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. Thanks to Saul Rubin and Rebecca Rottenberg for production support. Our intern is Naomi Bierenbaum.